paper 31, section 4, which is on old single column, page 348. All right, so just a quick little reminder. If you weren't with us last week, as longtime readers know, last paper of part one, last three papers, as I've pointed out, power, order, ascension. And in this last paper, you're not only you're talking about the final phases of your ascension, getting to paradise, having residential status on paradise, getting inducted into the core of finality, and who else is there with you in a mortal finality core. But in that whole big picture of origin, history, destiny, you had an origin. The Father initiated you on a lowly animal origin sphere, and you have a long, long history under your belt at this point of ascending. And you know, so remember that you're trying to understand what exactly is my true destiny. I can't understand my destiny from a bottom-up point of view. And how profound that is in terms of the history of epical revelations of God the Father. You know, that origin is in God the Father. And you can recognize that. But if you extrapolate that to a destiny, it won't be true. That isn't your destiny. Your destiny isn't to take an oath to the Universal Father. So, not only in little things, but even the biggest of things, this is true, that you can't understand destinies from origins. And for the first time in human history, the truth of our destiny has been revealed. We can finally get really on the top of our whole nature, our eternal nature, and look down and begin to get a valid understanding of who we are. And as we've pointed out, we discover we take an oath to the Paradise Trinity, and that everything that humans have ever imagined about themselves has just been turned upside down by the fifth epical revelation. That it's all very different than we imagined. That what we're all about fundamentally is a growing relationship with existential deity, not just existential deity, but experiential deity. And that dual relationship is even, you know, even when you say that, it's not what you'd immediately expect. It's like, okay, so a long time we've had some vague sense of the existential deity part. So that must be the dominant element still, even when the fifth epical revelation starts telling me about experiential deity. But again, that's like, no, that's not the truth of it. That it's the whole other side of the picture, the picture that's founded in the Paradise Trinity and gives rise to experiential deity, that's the dominant element. And it doesn't become undeniably manifest in the story until there you are on Paradise taking that oath, you know, and recognizing who you're... Even saying who, see? What, in a sense, see? The deity that you are taking an oath to. So that fact is primary in what we're what we're thinking about here. And so we'll see that when we read this tiny little paragraph about the adopted seraphim, we'll talk about that a little bit more. We'll notice kind of what they're doing with some names here in this list of only six, remember, because we have an unknown seventh member, group of beings that are for the membership in the mortal finality corps. But in this list of six, what exactly did they choose for designations for those six different categories? Okay, so let's read that and see what they give us here.
Okay, this is paper 31, the core of the finality, section 4, adopted seraphim. Many of the faithful seraphic guardians of mortals are permitted to go through the ascendant career with their human wards, and many of these guardian angels, after becoming father-fused, join their subjects in taking the finaliter oath of eternity and forever accept the destiny of their mortal associates. Angels who pass through the ascending experience of mortals, of mortal beings, may share the destiny of human nature. They may equally and eternally be mustered into this core of the finality. Large numbers of the adopted and glorified seraphim are attached to the various non-mortal finaliter corps.
Okay, so the first thing, let's just note that last little item, because I alluded to that. Remember when we went through the first group, the Havona natives, and we got to the end, and they said not only do they enter the mortal finality corps, but there were three other corps as well, so that there were four possible ones for the Havona natives, and I mentioned, we'll see that others have more general, and here you see it. So the seraphim could end up in any of the seven, it appears. If there is a qualification, they've kept it pretty silent there. It looks like it's a general opening for the seraphim into all the different corps. If that is the case, as it appears, that wouldn't be unexpected. Talking about individuals who are fundamentally the children of the third source and center. So everything comes together, all power and pattern, all creatorship and controlling, come together. As we've talked about, the third source and center is this incredible font of diversity. It's not surprising if you actually do get seraphim all the way to this exalted state that they might, be able to go into a lot of different avenues. Okay? But now notice the names. As you just glance right in front of you here, you see the next two are glorified material sons, glorified midway creatures. If you flip back, or if you remember, it was glorified mortals before that. But here it's adopted seraphim. But you noticed what they said in the text there. They said large numbers of the adopted and glorified seraphim. So glorified applies as well to them. Everyone is obviously becoming glorified, like I said, exalted, to reach this high estate of being inducted into a core of the finality. But why did they put the adopted? What fundamentally is going on here? They're all taking oaths to the Paradise Trinity. And as we've touched on so many times in the past papers here in part one, fundamentally what the picture is about is that what springs from that fundamental relationship between the Infinite Spirit and the Paradise Trinity, that's the root engine for all of the phenomenon that we see here. I mean, that's the starting point for manifesting all of the beings that are going to come under this other aspect of deity, experiential deity, is where the God of action, as the Infinite Spirit, which is the non-personal side, meets the non-personalizable Paradise Trinity in that fundamental dual relationship. Okay, and this is all about being glorified so that you have the fullness of relationship to the Paradise Trinity to be part of one of these finality cores. But with the seraphim, there's another thing. They're not just going to be glorified. They have to be adopted across that relationship, handed from the infinite spirit to the Paradise Trinity. They have to be adopted by the Paradise Trinity from the infinite spirit. Okay, so that's, you know, they're, by putting that in the name, they're reminding you of that. So you just see it again. It's, you know, it's everywhere in here. And it's, like I've mentioned, you only become come to really appreciate that the fundamentality of that relationship when you start to unpack the central universe. And since I've worked through that, that's why I've been mentioning it all along here, because it's like, okay, now you understand a lot of what's going on. That not only is the Paradise Trinity key, but then in terms of that existential deity, in many ways you have the three persons, where in this, there's, in terms of the third person, it's the conjoint actor. In many ways, they're behind the scenes in a very existential deity fashion. And it's that non-personal face of the third source and center that really injects itself, you know, into relationship with the Paradise Trinity and generates all, you know, all this that we're reading about, this whole cosmology.
Yeah, yeah. But, and then they also talk about them being father fused.
All right.
So is that after the fact, correct? In other words, they become father fused, you know, right before this stage. So
right. I mean, at some point when they, you know, they've made it through Seraphington, you know, all the ascending seraphim, no matter what they're going to end up doing, go through Seraphington, including these ones that, you know, get into the fine outer core. You know, and then subsequent to that, they have the capacity then to take a father fragment. Okay, so just like the Havona natives, this is not an adjuster, but it is a father fragment. Whereas when you talk about material sons and midway creatures, secondary midway creatures, you're talking about father fragments. Or, I mean, you're talking about adjusters, you know, for that type of father fragment, excuse me. And as we'll see in a second, they'll mention that about the secondary midwayers. But, so that's the key. Just notice that. And then the flip side is to appreciate, again, why they said glorified mortals, just glorified material sons, just glorified midwayers, midway creatures. Because that's the whole aha. That finally, when all is said and done, those three groups of beings recognize that they're actually Trinity origin creatures. Not existential Trinity origin creatures, but experiential Trinity origin creatures. So they're not Trinity origin like a divine counselor is an existential Trinity origin creature. But see, they're... all they have to do is just be glorified into the fullness of that fact, that that's what they are. And then they take an oath to the Paradise Trinity that they are of. See, that's what what you're discovering here in this, is that, and it's why, if you look for origin, history, destiny in the book, that classic passage, where do you find it? You find it in a paper about Trinity origin beings. Right? And they're talking about the Trinity teacher sons. Right? And that Trinity origin, not in the son paper about the Trinity teacher sons, but in the coordinate Trinity origin beings paper. Because see, that's what, you know, remember they said, we're basically not going to talk about the Trinity teacher sons right here. We're going to wait until we get to the Paradise sons, talk a lot about them, you know, how they serve as part of the epics on a mortal world and that sort of stuff. They say, we're going to take this opportunity to teach you, like the Trinity teacher sons will teach you. Yeah. You go through a little lesson, and it says, talks about origin, history, destiny. You know, yeah, what's that Trinity origin being, existential Trinity origin being, that Trinity teacher son going to teach you? That you too are a Trinity origin being. But the other side of the picture, you know, fully coalescing out of experiential deity rather than just flashing into existence as an existential phenomenon relative to the Paradise Trinity. And that's what your whole ascension career is about, is acquiring the wholeness of nature that you can finally be what you're destined to be, an eternal servant of the Paradise Trinity. The Paradise Trinity's child. That's our destiny. That's what fundamentally wasn't there in the I Am. The Father doesn't need any help existing. He wasn't lacking in existence in the I Am. Infinity of existence was, is, and forever shall be, you know, in eternity. What was missing is the rest of the story. So that's, you know, we're part of the rest of the story about experience. We have to actually, you know, we have to, of course, you know, be made to exist, the first step. But that's it. You know, the Father brings you into existence, and then the whole rest of the story is about coming into relationship with experiential deity. You know, and it's, I am, and then you go, well, now what? One must do something as well as be something, and everyone knows what that doing is about. You know, it's about coming into relationship with experiential deity. Okay, so so that's why I adopted, see. And you know, in a sense, there's as much importance in just the title, see, as there is in that little paragraph. You know, it just getting you to notice what they called them. Okay. Now, one other thing, because they mentioned it is back at the beginning of the glorified, when they're talking about the glorified mortals. You remember when they were talking about there are just 10 of those non-mortal, non-seraphic personalities. You know, they lumped the mortals and the seraphim together. So can you see why they did? Because there's two poles in this relationship. That's the anchor of this whole phenomenon. The infinite spirit on the one side, the Paradise Trinity on the other side. See, even further stressing how you're on the Paradise Trinity side. So the seraphim a lot of, you know, you don't have to repeat a lot of what they said about the mortals, because when all is said and done, he really kind of, once the seraphim were adopted, a lot of what you would say about the seraphim is what you already said about the mortals. That difference is finally overcome by and large. Now, it doesn't mean you still can't tell the difference. Remember, they tell you that you can walk up, you can tell if someone used to be a seraphim when you talk to a finaliter as opposed to used to be a mortal. But you know, you've really bound that, the differential across that, you know, the potential across that relationship between the infinite spirit and the Paradise Trinity, you've bound that eternally together in a super additive consequence embodied in a finaliter core. So it's a that allows you to further appreciate why the revelators are so in awe of finaliter cores. They know how deep the anchor goes and how unfathomable, see, the potential then is. You know, there's not much more fundamental than a relationship between the Paradise Trinity and the Infinite Spirit. That's pretty high stuff. And to be part of the super additive consequence of that means, that's why they say we really are very hesitant to put too many limits on a destiny at the ends of experiential eternity, you know, at the ends of future eternity. Okay. All right, so let's now look at kind of a, you know, in some ways, it's kind of an asterisk to a glorified mortals, that you have these these pattern mortals, as it were, you know, those material sons and daughters, and how they fit into this picture.
Five, glorified material sons. There is provision in the universes of time and space whereby the Adamic citizens of the local systems, when long delayed in receiving planetary assignment, may initiate a petition for release from permanent citizenship status. And if granted, they join the ascending pilgrims on the universe capitals and thence proceed onward to paradise and the core of the finality.
Okay, we're just about to read. I mean, that's mode one. There's multiple modes for material sons and daughters getting into the finality of Corvus, but that's one way. So, you know, if you have all of the offspring, you have generations and generations of offspring, and the initial pair, material son and daughter pair in a local system, you know, that are accumulating on the headquarters of the local system. You know, they occasionally go on to missions to be Adams and Eves, etc. But if after a long time they're still there, they can say, how about if I just, you know, you got plenty here. How about if I head on up? And they get a thumbs up and off they go. But they've got to be humanized some way, as we'll see, because eventually they've got to be able to take on an adjuster. You know, you're talking about this being that as long as they don't, default or rebel, they're this eternal, very material creature that exists on and on and on with no adjuster. You know, they don't ascend. They're, you know, that permanent citizenship. You know, they're basically a horizontal rather than a vertical being by birth. Okay, so that they're going to change that. They're going to become an upward arrow, and that's what, remember, human means, up from the humus, right? Yeah, they're going to become an upward arrow. That's what it means to be humanized. Now, and when they do that, they will. They obviously have a very high nature, so they're going to have, you know, once they're transformed like that, they're going to have a capacity to receive an adjuster, and they're obviously going to fuse in quite short order. And you notice what they're saying, that for those, do they go through mansion worlds or constellation? No, they go right to the universe capital and start ascending from there. So they're, like we were saying, you know, they're, in many ways, they're sort of a pattern mortal. So just like those worlds that are very far along, and the mortals, a lot of those mortals are skipping over all of the lower levels of the Marantia career. See, they're in that mode of a very advanced mortal and just jump right to the local universe headquarters. All right, so a couple other modes here.
When an advanced evolutionary world attains the later eras of the Age of Light and Life, the material sons, the planetary Adam and Eve, may elect to humanize, receive adjusters, and embark upon the evolutionary course of universe ascent leading to the core of mortal finalities. Certain of these material sons have partially failed or technically defaulted in their mission as biologic accelerators, as Adam did on Urantia. And then are they compelled to take the natural course of the peoples of the realm, receive adjusters, pass through death, and progress by faith through the ascendant regime, subsequently attaining paradise in the core of the finality.
Okay, see, so, related, but two different modes. One, they go all the way through into light and life, and it's, you have to get, you know, relatively deeply settled in light and life. It may be all the way into seventh stage light and life on the planet, but at some point, the Adam and Eve are released from duty, and they're humanized, and off they go. And then all of those that didn't actually rebel, but just defaulted, and that they rehabilitated themselves, and, like our Adam and Eve. And you'll see it in the next paragraph, but just appreciate the contrast between those Adam and Eves. Okay, they're both, you know, not just material sons and daughters, but Adams and Eves. But in the case of the pair that stay all the way through, you know, deep into light and life, you know, they're a very, very tightly bound pair. You know, we shouldn't be surprised if we see some interesting consequences of that as we read in the next paragraph. You had something there?
So you think the rebellion ones, you remember, like, in the Lucifer Rebellion, there was hundreds of thousands that went over, and then Jesus, you know, them, not that many yet,
right,
took forgiveness, but quite a few.
Right, if some, yeah.
So those guys who took forgiveness entered into this
battle. Yeah, right.
Those
so
guys who didn't are...
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a well. Remember, everything is still in limbo, and you know, on in terms of those who didn't repent and who actually went fully into.
And they don't.
But yeah, yeah. So, and just that, if they do default, now that makes them even more like us. You know, so when you talk about that humanized, there's the. You know, there's that humanization process that's done artificially, I guess you'd say, you know, by the powers that be to these other ones. But here, there's a self-humanizing. See, so when all is said and done, they've actually, you know, given themselves a potential that's a little bit more like us. You know, that they experienced a little bit more of the lower realms of the whole vertical space by humanizing themselves, by unplugging themselves, by disrupting their relationship to mind.
I understand that a number of the material sons and daughters did rebel on the...
Yeah, that was just John was just pointing
exactly.
out. Yeah.
But... on the planets, on most planets, it's kind of rare. I was under the impression that it was rare that the Adam and Eve would fail, such as ours did. Apparently,
it's,
that's not the case.
I think you're conflating. I mean, it's you know, it's rather rare for a planetary prince, perhaps you could say. But, you know, I mean, in many ways...
not for Adam and Eve.
Well, they were the ones who were on Jerusalem, the ones on...
Yes, Jerusalem. I know. That's
they weren't necessarily on the planet.
Right.
But the ones that are on planets, I was curious. I wasn't aware that it was relatively...
Right. I mean, there's a number of things in play. I mean, obviously, if the planetary prince stays in Tigris, okay, it's you probably... The Adam and Eve will probably be fine. Okay. I didn't quite finish the thing I said before. I mean, it's quite rare to have a system rebellion and have planetary princes tied to that. Okay. But aside from that, you know, relatively rare phenomenon. I mean, there's going to be some greater number of planetary princes. Who independently of their system sovereign, you know, go into fault or rebellion. And you don't really have much of a sense at all about the default part of a planetary prince. You know, you have a couple of references to the non-system planetary prince rebellion phenomenon. Okay, but a planetary prince defaulting, you know, that might trip up an Adam and Eve. So,
sure.
See, so that it's not going to be hyper rare. See, there, yeah, there's a number of avenues that you can appreciate where this could happen. Okay. We don't have any sense of the statistics of it, though, that I can remember. I mean, he's remembering that line about how many. Can you find it, Andre?
I can.
But, but as I recall, I mean, correct me if I'm remembering wrong, Andre, isn't that one you're looking for in general? It's not just Adam and Eve's, it's all material sons and daughters?
Give me a key.
I think. I think it is. So, yeah, like I said, I don't...
No, it's just Adam's and Eve. There's one...
Oh, do you think there is? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Here we go.
Okay.
On page... paper 51, section 1, paragraph 5. An original or directly created Adam and Eve are immortal by inherent endowment, just as are all other orders of local universe sonship. But a diminution of immortality potential characterizes their sons and daughters. This original couple cannot transmit unconditioned immortality to their procreated sons and daughters. Their progeny are dependent for continuing life on unbroken intellectual synchrony with the mind-gravity circuit of the spirit. Since the inception of the system of Satania, 13 planetary atoms have been lost in rebellion and default, and 681,204 in the subordinate positions of trust.
Okay, yeah, so we don't...
Most of these defections occurred at the time of the Lucifer Rebellion. Another time, I think they say it was 95%.
Right, see, so that's what I said. I didn't think that they've separated out the, you know, just the Adam and Eve defaulting thing, you know, separate from all the material sons and daughters in general. You know, see, so that's what I was saying. I didn't think we had a, but that gives you some ballpark estimate anyway 13, for kind of the...
13 planetary atoms, that's all.
Right. I mean, in terms of both rebellion and default.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So... Yeah, so, you know, you have somewhere in between that little number where it's fully rebellion and default and a much bigger number for all the material sons and daughters, you know. So, but it's, you know, like you said, it's not tiny, you know. It's obviously some sort of a significant number of just Adam and, you know, and Eve's, you know, let alone other material sons and daughters, but just Adam and Eve's. It might end up in this third mode of having defaulted for whatever reason. And okay. All right. Thanks for looking that up, Andre. Okay, so, you know, but that, you know, but it's just interesting to think about, you know, we have a tendency initially to think of it in such a negative mode about a defaulting Adam and Eve, but when all is said and done, there's this whole avenue of experience and hence experiential nature that they can acquire that a normal Adam and Eve or just a material son and daughter can acquire. So they've come to a finality core. You know, our Adam and Eve will bring to a finality core something that, you know, the run-of-the-mill material son and daughter can't bring to the service of the Paradise Trinity. Okay? So, you know, and just when you say it that way, when you think about that, that's the whole point, is to be of service to the Paradise Trinity and the experiential deity that stems from the Paradise Trinity, in all experience is good experience when all is said and done. The only way that, you know, that can't be ultimately true for you yourself is if you go all the way to experiencing iniquity, okay? But even then, your process of going to iniquity gave your adjuster incredible value, gave the supreme incredible value. I mean, it literally made that adjuster a supreme adjuster. How much greater potential relationship to the Paradise Trinity and experiential deity do you have if you're a supreme adjuster, see? So you can begin to see how this is sort of just obvious. Once you really put it in the context of the Paradise Trinity and experiential deity, that's what it's all about, it should really help to bias you away from the tendency mankind has been in forever, because if it's only really known about existential deity, it gets you into this black and white, false understanding of things where you have perfect on the one side and imperfect on the other side. And that's not true. You have perfect on one side and you have perfecting on the other side. And it doesn't matter how many asterisks you stick on perfecting, it's still perfecting. Any flavor, doesn't matter what happened. It all, you know, becomes part of what wasn't there in the I Am, that whole vast accumulating experiential phenomenon that is why we exist, to experience whatever, you know. So, you know, if you can challenge yourself to not be so biased about, I only want to experience things that I think are like the Father. No, you want to just experience. Yeah, don't put any qualifications on it. Let it all just be good. Now is a divine dispensation, as it says in the up in the Jesus Papers. And this is why. Because it's about experiential deity.
However, you
do. All things can be
right
taken.
And wrong in your heart somewhere.
Oh, no, I mean, yeah, it doesn't mean there's not right and wrong, but even wrong, right. You know, ends up in goodness. Everything except that which doesn't exist becomes part of the total goodness of the finite. It's just the fact of it. So that's part of what this is trying to get you to really stress. I mean, to just let go of all of the old modes of trying to rationalize things and setting up a false, you know, pretense for your life. That's what fixating on your origin in the Father will do to you. You don't want to fixate on that. You know, you want to set your eyes on your destiny, which is the Paradise Trinity and the fullness of experience. Okay, let's get this last little bit then. Oh, is there another question back here?
I was thinking on SOS you had said that Adam and Eve chose to be lonely that first day. And what it brought to mind when you had said that was that they had that depth of feeling, and that must have been a great thing for them to have such a human reaction.
Yeah, and it's great that you just mentioned that, because you can see that's what comes up in this next paragraph.
Oh.
Yeah, just notice how that's between the lines of this next paragraph.
These material sons are not to be found in many finaliter companies. Their presence lends great potential to the possibilities of high service for such a group, and they are invariably chosen as its leaders. If both of the Edenic pair are attached to the same group, they are usually permitted to function jointly as one personality. Such ascendant pairs are far more successful in the adventure of trinitizing than are the ascendant mortals.
Okay, a whole bunch of things in that last little paragraph there. Okay, so you see the fact that they are definitely patterned, mortals in a sense, so that they're invariably chosen as the leaders in a mortal finality core. It's sort of just the pattern for a mortal. So that's, pretty obvious why that would be. But you notice it says they're not found in many. Even though we might come up with a relatively, big number, relative number of ascenders total, okay, it's a drop in the bucket, how many material sons and daughters there are. So obviously they're not going to be large numbers of them in the mortal finality course. Not to mention a whole bunch of them are probably destined for other things that are kind of that we don't quite understand yet. There's all these things that about what's going to go on towards the end of Light and Life in the Grand Universe that we aren't certain about. But anyway, the other things here. Okay, now, let's take the last thing first, and we'll take the other part after that. They're far more successful. See, so again, that's related to that pattern fact. Now, if you're going to have two finaliters making a creature trinitized son, the more definitively expressed they are, the more likely they have to have success. It's like, well, okay, so what does it mean to be more definitively expressed? Well, we're talking about trinitizing, again, this relationship to the Paradise Trinity. Okay, so at that point, okay, now, why, when you think of it that way, okay, on the one hand, yeah, they're a pattern mortal, and you can say they're kind of a father origin. I mean, the local universe father brought them into existence, kind of like we were talking about us being initiated by the Father. But, see, if they're going to be more effective than that, okay, that's saying that they're more definitively, fundamentally related to the Paradise Trinity. than mortals. Okay, now why is that? Remember, like I just said, who brings material sons and daughters into existence?
Creator sons.
Just creator sons.
Right.
A son, quote unquote, someone who is has the deity of father, son, bringing material daughters into existence. Wait a minute. Remember, that's, you know, there is a recessive deity fact within a creator son, because it's eternal mother son. There's mother deity bonded to that son deity of the eternal mother son when the creator son is brought into existence. You know, the creator sons weren't brought into existence before the eternal son was the eternal mother son, subsequent to the eternal son becoming eternal mother son. So there's mother deity, which is, stems from the Paradise Trinity. So there's a fundamental recessive linkage to the Paradise Trinity inherent in that creator son, which is finally fully glorified and brought to the fore here. That fact that there's that deep foundation in the Paradise Trinity to begin with makes them more successful in making creature trinitized sons. You know? So that phenomenon that, I mean, it's not very hidden because immediately there's these material daughters. But we all know that they even did it right there. They said, as Adam did on Urantia. They didn't say as Adam and Eve did. Remember, there's always that tendency, you know, to speak of them as material sons in general rather than material sons and daughters, because they're first and foremost sons, both of them, just as we're ascending sons, be we begin as male or female. Okay, but you know, here you finally have it. When all is said and done, you are seeing that Trinity coming out. Okay, and that ties into that other thing. If both the of the Edenic pair. Okay, so you seem to be really talking about not ones that are still on local system headquarters, but ones that have actually become Adams and Eves. Okay, if both the Edenic pair are attached to the same group, they are usually permitted to function jointly. Now, there's another spot where they talk about them, quote unquote, functioning jointly. It's, you know, in the fullness of light and life on a world for their release, they use that same expression. And in that, okay, so the usually is, if you're talking about an Edenic pair that actually do go all the way deep into light and life and then get released, okay, that they're going to function, notice it's it's function jointly. So, you know, when they say as one personality, okay, I mean they're two personalities, you know, and they count for two in the thousand, okay. But if there's going to be a leader, they lead jointly. That's what they mean by that. Just as they led jointly on the world, that's when they use that expression, function jointly, okay, they don't somehow, you know, merge into one personality. I mean, don't take it that literally. They just function as one personality. And in that context, just recognizing, how is it that a material son and daughter can do that, can function basically as if they were one personality when they're two?
Kindred minds.
Yeah, I mean, they have a... they have a commonality in the unity of the Paradise Trinity. See, that's also manifesting there. In the Paradise Trinity, they are one. So you're seeing the mother deity origin of them also coming out there. That even while they're still working on a mortal sphere, they can get to the point where they are so bound together. They're like the unity of the indivisibleness of the Paradise Trinity. You remember how right up in the foreword they tell you that, you know, indivisible deity of the Paradise Trinity. So you're seeing that there too. So of course, when they're actually taking an oath to Paradise Trinity, you're going to find out, of course, they're going to be in that mode very definitively. See, but the usually is, why is the usually there? Are Adam and Eve going to? No, our Adam and Eve are part of the exception there. What did our Adam and Eve do?
We separated.
They really, see, and Terry mentioned that. They really let go of that fiat linkage in the Paradise Trinity by choosing that separateness and humanizing and... And that's why they're two separate individuals in the 420 counselors. I mean, sometimes Eve comes as the resident governor general. Sometimes Adam comes. Okay, they don't function jointly. See, they separated themselves. They made themselves more like humans, like I said. I mean, they are very, very dependent upon each other because of this linkage to the Paradise Trinity, the Mother. Unless they default and separate themselves. And then they become more like us, where, there's a definite difference between male and female.
Why do we have so much divorce?
There's a definite difference between male and female. Okay, but with humans, we were purposely made so that we aren't as dependent upon the other as a material son and daughter. Because on a mortal world, a lot of times one of the parents is going to die for some reason. And the other parent's got to take up some of the slack. So they've got to be able to be more independent. See, more son-like, if you will, a little more tied to the individual nature, the Father as the initiator, rather than the unity nature of the Paradise Trinity. So now you see how it all fits together. See, so that's the deal in that previous paragraph when they talk about those that defaulted. See, they're going to be a lot more like us in that they're going to have an individual integrity like we will in the core of the finality. So, you know, our Adam and Eve may be in totally separate finality, of course.
Yeah, another question.
Yeah, I was just going to say, since the first there's the eternal son and then there's the eternal mother son, and that gives the pattern for that in the universes, so... Without the eternal mother son, there would be no female or male. It has to be the eternal mother son for both, and that's how we have the male and the female on down. I don't think it could be any other way.
The relationship between when you talk about if you call the eternal mother son the universal mother, quote unquote, they point out that. From kind of more of the existential side, you can recognize the pattern you're talking about, why there's a male and a female on this planet. Okay. As I've tried to bring out, once you begin to go beyond the seven absolutes of infinity and a little bit more about just an existential deity viewpoint, you can begin to recognize that that pattern of father, mother, and hence male, female, is actually bigger than that pair of the universal father, eternal mother, son. That's how you can initially begin to recognize it. But as soon as you recognize that, you know, you're immediately challenged, like, well, wait a minute, there's the infinite mother spirit, too. There's mother there. And then they talk about the... God the Supreme as being the universal mother, and et cetera. I mean, in the fullness of deity, you can recognize that you have two overarching facets of deity, the Father on one side and the Mother on the other side, and that duality is greater than the universal Father, eternal Mother, Son, and that all mother deity and experiential deity is on that side with the mother, and all existential deity, even the Isle, is on the side with the Father. Yeah. So start with that. Start with it, but recognize the more you get into the revelation, the more you see that another way you can tell the story of in the conceptual beginning was the I Am. Another way you can tell that story is in the conceptual beginning, you know, there was the theoretical God the Infinite, and that God the Infinite separated into God the Father and God the Mother. And that God the Mother is not just the Eternal Mother Son. You know, it's everything in that picture. So the fact that there's female and male is, you know, is even bigger than the first two persons. Okay, it's a very, very fundamental duality that is only now recognizable with the fifth epical revelation. Okay. Yep.
So when you remember the whole process of trinitization, you know, which is really two beings come together with something new that they create. That, you know, it doesn't happen. They don't succeed most of the time. These guys have been together, you know, the whole time.
Right.
So it might be a whole lot easier, as they say, they're more successful. For them to be able to create that, you know, it's not like I'm going to trinitize with one of my wives. I wouldn't doubt it. Pretty good. But they've been together the whole time, so there maybe that's another reason why it's a little bit easier for them.
Yes, I mean, and I see. All I'm appreciating is that is. That's just built in. It's innate, and unless they break that,
yeah.
It's there. To manifest more and more and more, you know, as they exist. They were created as one in many ways. See, I mean, let's think another way of thinking about what the mother deity of the Eternal Mother Son, you know, that's within the Creator Son that gives rise to these material sons and daughters, how much that mother deity bonds the two together, the material sons and daughters. Think about the reflective mother spirits. The spirit deity part of a reflective mother spirit, you know, and you just call them a reflective spirit, okay? In our super universe, you have seven reflective spirits. And as a spirit, there's seven, you know, very separate facts. But they're one mother. The reflective mother spirits are not seven mothers, they're one mother. So there's seven spirits, but one mother. See, it's the same way here. They're a material son and daughter, but one. You know, in the mother deity aspect, just like with the seven reflective mother spirits, they're just very innately one expression of the Paradise Trinity. And that's what they're saying. See, they function as one personality. They've taken an oath to the Paradise Trinity. It's like they're really one child of the Paradise Trinity, you know, in that fundamental relationship they have to the Trinity. Their separateness is as a relationship to Father and Son. Yeah. But in that fundamental relationship to the Paradise Trinity, see, they're just innately one. And if they don't break that, that's another reason why, if they don't break that, they live on.
We have we have the XX, and the male we have the XY. If it's all coming from...
Think about that just in what we were just understanding there. If fundamentally we are experiential Trinity origin beings, if you just let the foundation be where you have just XX... that's going to represent the foundation. And lo and behold, that's a female. If you differentiate from that foundation by, you know, modifying the foundation, making one X a Y, then you get something that is male. You get something that is separated from that foundation of the Trinity a little bit, functions a little bit more like the Son part, just like I was saying. But then we remember, you know, that sure enough, the XX is the foundation. The hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. What's our destiny? Who do we take an oath to? Okay. See? Which, male or female, which is that true of? Which is the more fundamentally bound to the Paradise Trinity so that some of their destiny is there from the beginning? The female. Okay. Okay. So that's we're trying to understand this. It's true. This is a universal thing. It changes the way you understand everything, including when biology.
My says I got to get in touch with my female
side. when you get to paper 117, here, let's just turn to it. When you get to paper 117, it says about your entire local universe career, the mother influence dominates the human personality throughout the local universe childhood of the growing soul. Because of what we're talking about, the mother influence, because that's what it's all about. You have this very complicated process involving the existential deity and stuff, but when all is said and done, what you're trying to do is coalesce into a fact that when it goes out as a finality, it is God the Mother revealing that which takes an oath to the Paradise Trinity, that which stems from the Paradise Trinity, that which is mother-like.
I would think that the male, then, having the X and the Y, would be much more able to understand the X part of their life. Whereas we, how come we, with this double X, can understand so much more?
Okay. Or so the bias seems.
See, okay. You're mistaking this for fractional letters of the alphabet, one thing. But in reality, that Y is a broken X.
We don't want to go off on this tangent, but I mean, remember, most of what I'm saying, if you think about it, has not been said by humans before. It's only in the wake of papers like this. It's like, this is not obvious in our ignorance. These facts about XX and XY are by no means apparent, because both XXs and XYs are very ignorant creatures to begin with. And because they're very ignorant, they're very biased. They're very subjective. They both think the universe revolves around them.
X is always ask why.
And so do Ys. Okay. Enough said. That should be self-evident, you know, the issues in play. I mean, but just appreciate that. It's not surprising that we have all these difficulties that we do as male and females on a mortal world. How far are we removed from these facts of destiny? But there are little glimpses, like I'm trying to say. I mean, the recognition of that hand that rocks the cradle. Now, just like an Adam and Eve can break their kind of innate linkage to the Paradise Trinity, so can a female. Remember, that's the bottom line. You're reading the Marriage and Family Life papers, you know, and in the midst of all that, they don't say, now, guys, we need to have a talk. No, it's, now, gals, we need to have a talk. Because when you're given liberty with a personality from the Father, you have the liberty, the free will, to break your unrecognized link to the Paradise Trinity. You now can choose to be less innately bound to the foundation of all things. And they say, how are you going to respond to this newfound liberty? Are you going to forget that you're the foundation of connection to the Trinity? Are you going to go all father-like? Are you going to misuse the personality gift? I mean, you know, and so... So you have things in the Revelation that are helping you with that. What we're reading right now about how we're both trying to get to taking an oath to Paradise Trinity. I've got a lot farther journey. But you'll have just as far a journey if you break your innate link and kind of start where I do. Okay? And then you've got to go through the whole process of trying to find the Paradise Trinity. You know, and then getting to a glorified state where you can take an oath to the Paradise Trinity. You know, so, you know, don't break that.
Yeah. Embrace your ex. Don't ask why.
And, you know, and all of that, it has to be done in the midst of an immortal world. We function, you know, we have, I mean, all these issues, the pragmatic issues, and I'm not dismissing those, and those all have to come into play, but it has a lot to do with, you know, getting to equity and not equality, for instance. You know, thinking there's equity in the Paradise Trinity. Okay? Those sorts of things come into play. So, yeah, so just you know, notice how all the consequences of what we're talking about, how it has all kinds of consequences for how we understand ourselves and what we're supposed to be up to, and how many things we are given that we don't recognize. Okay.
John had something.
Is there more?
Oh, I was just going to add to it, but
okay.
It helped me see, I mean, her bringing up the XY thing, because it was always jumbled in my mind. Maybe that's why women inherently, they say in the book, appear more spiritual, you know, because they have that by that more bonding to the big picture, you know, and that appears, you know, whereas men have this extra, you know, why that helps them ferret through the big picture, kind of, you know, whatever.
Well, again, just, you know, I mean, just, you know, you can think about this a lot, but just, you know, appreciate that that's what's going on, is this fact that the unrecognized fact of the Paradise Trinity and how this is part of our foundation. And, you know, and just another thing about, you know, about the challenge for a female to not dismiss the value of what they're unrecognizably given, you know, in this relationship to the Trinity. You can go the path of Eve and break that link. You know, it's you don't fall as far because we aren't like we just read, we aren't as innately bound to the Trinity as the material sons and daughters, but see, it's so these stories, like the Adam and Eve story being restored to us and statements about this, they all have to do with understanding how we are supposed to, how we're supposed to think about ourselves as more, and create a society that's predicated more on our destiny than our origin in history. Yeah. That's what the Revelation is trying to do. Get us to reform everything predicated on an understanding of destiny rather than a limited understanding of origin and history and the exaltation of it. Okay. Flip everything around.
It's a rich story. Otherwise, people come up with these thin concoctions that just, you know, shrivel off in the ozone.
Yep. All right. So now let's get the other little element here that's kind of an asterisk in the mortal core. The Midwayers.
6. Glorified Midway Creatures. On many planets, the Midway creatures are produced in large numbers, but they seldom tarry on their native world subsequent to its being settled in light and life. Then, or soon thereafter, they are released from permanent citizenship status and start on the ascension to paradise, passing through the Morontia worlds, the super universe, and Havona in company with the mortals of time and space. The Midway creatures from various universes differ greatly in origin and nature, but they are all destined to one or another of the Paradise Finality Core. The secondary Midwayers are all eventually adjuster-fused and are mustered into the Mortal Core. Many Finality companies have one of these glorified beings in their group.
Okay, so let's kind of deal with that last in relationship with the material sons as well. Okay, so you notice the material sons, like I said, they're kind of patterned mortals. So, you know, they go into the mortal core. And the secondary midwayers are literally adjuster fused and go in and are all mustered into the mortal core. But the primary midwayers, unlike the secondaries that are a lot like mortals, the primary midwayers are more like seraphim. Okay? And so they're going to be like the seraphim, where it's not an adjuster, it's a another type of father fragment that they fuse with. And they, looks like, can end up in all the different cores, like the seraphim. So with the midway creatures, there ends up being, you know, on the one side, it's a little bit more like just like the glorified mortals, but on the other side, you have a little bit more of the adopted and glorified thing going on, see? And because of their tighter relationship to the infinite spirit, a greater diversity of potential destiny in the mortal core, or in the cores, the different cores besides the mortal core. Okay, and then you know, we were mentioning about the Adam and Eve's getting released, and that occurs pretty deep into light and life. Especially if, I don't know if you remember, with light and life on a world, that's when a core of finaliters starts to become a significant part of the administration of a world. Okay, and if there's a midwayer in that mortal core, I mean, in that finaliter core, excuse me. If there's a midwayer in that finaliter core, then they tell you that the midwayers on the planet are immediately released. Okay, which is kind of an interesting thing. So the very fact that there might be like just one midwayer, say, in that finaliter core, you know, all the midwayers, you know, get released. But they, you know, if that's not the case, they may be, you know, into light and life a ways before they get released, you know, not just immediately in the first stage, you know, like sort of immediately post Morantia Temple. Okay, so that's the, you know, if you go to the light and life paper, you see that.
I thought of this last week and I forgot to ask. The finalities, when they come back after being sworn into the finality, the core of the finality, they come back and they serve on spheres of light and life. How come we've got 1,000 on? We are way far from light and life.
Okay, they remember they say there's at least one, you know, group here, one company here. There may be more than 1,000.
Right.
Okay, the finalers do lots and lots of different things.
Yeah.
Basically, the sense you get that they do a plethora of odds and ends jobs. The one kind of definitive thing that everyone has noticed that they're up to is issues of light and life.
Right.
If a planet is settled in light and life, you know, they're very definitively part of that administration, you know, and higher levels of higher units being settled in light and life. So, you know, it's not because we're anywhere near light and life that they're here. That
need not be said.
You know, so they're doing lots of things pre-light and life. But even when they're out and about doing all kinds of odds and ends job, everyone gets the sense that their ultimate modus operandi of whatever it is that they're doing is tweaking things relative to light and life. Okay, relative to the grand universe being settled in light and life. That it may not be immediately apparent at all, but everyone suspects that in some subtle way, when we all get to the grand universe being settled in light and life, we'll look back on everything that every finaliter ever did, and it's like, yes, there was a grand conspiracy the whole time. Everything they were doing, you know, had this very far-sighted character to it. Yeah.
And they say that the half of them are on assignment and the other half are on voluntary duty. That means that they could just pick any pet project and get together and pull it off independent.
Yeah, not numbers half-wise, but time-wise. You know, they spend equal time.
Right, you know, time-wise. Half their time is under assignment. The other half of their time is on voluntary work. So we thought, you know, when you see these amazing coincidences occur in the world, you can look at a finaliter volunteer group and say, maybe that's what was their pet project.
Maybe, of course, you know, and you know, I'll put in a plug for the Universal Mother here and Providence. Don't ever forget, that's another thing that we're working very hard to try to overcome in a history of our thinking about celestial things. We've always been biased to think in terms of intervention. You know, and so giving us a whole pile of beings instead of just angels. Our first thought is, wow, we've got 500,000 different opportunities for intervention now. We can have adjusters intervening. We can have finaliters intervening. We can have master seraphim intervening. We can have divine counselors intervening. Okay. Remember, more important than any being intervening,
I was going to say that.
You know, is the whole.
But I don't think I have.
You know, and you always want to, recognize that there may not have had to been any tweaking, that that coincidence, quote unquote, may be just innate in the integrity of the individuality of the whole, and that the most profound way you could recognize a prayer being answered, is that is to recognize that Father's changeless. Prayer can't change a changeless Father. If it seems like your prayer got answered, well, maybe because he answered it before time began, long before you prayed it. I mean, how does the Father know what you want before you ask for it? It's built into the whole. How is it built into the whole? Not because he has lots of fingers. It's built into the whole because the Paradise Trinity, the whole, and the individuality of the whole, the Mother. The deck is stacked to begin with, if you will. You know, there's an antecedent following. There's it's innately a whole. That issue of prayer, challenging yourself to trust a changeless God as opposed to believing that you can pray and change God. If you can pray and change God, you don't need to trust. You just need to have faith.
Change yourself.
Right, it can change yourself. But just, why do the revelators say that primitive religionists, crave a God and hears their prayers? Because primitive religionists believe in a changeable God, a God that can be changed by prayer, and that once you discover prayer, that sets you apart from your opponents, they have to get through life without a God that they can wield. Or if you're really primitive, it's dueling gods, They can wield their God with prayer, and you can wield your God with prayer, and then you duke it out God to God, and, who can pray the best wins. See, all those old modes, it's like, no, which do you want? A non-eternal, non-infinite, changeable God, or an eternal, infinite, changeless God? Well, if you like the latter, then you have to change your whole thought about prayer. What prayer is there for is to remind you to trust the infinite eternal God rather than believing you can wield him.
That's making prayer insignificant. And Jesus prayed.
Yes, he did. But that's what I'm
saying. And the purpose, is not to change God.
Right. But you see, that's part of the challenge of the fifth epical revelation. Can you see prayer as not diminished by what I've just said? See, that's our first instinct. It's like, wait a minute, you just took prayer away from me. Prayer doesn't have any value anymore. Does your relationship to the whole have value? Yes, it does. And anything that you do that unwittingly, even. Remember, you're programmed to pray at the lowest level because of how important it is. If my words led to the devaluation of prayer, then life carriers wouldn't design ascending mortals to pray, genetically. Okay? It has deep value you know, because of what I'm saying. It unwittingly, you know, in the process of thinking that you're wielding God because you got the right Latin incantation, what you unwittingly do is bind yourself to the whole a little bit. You actually begin to take part in this process that we're reading about the glorified endpoint of, beginning to bring yourself into relationship with the whole. You don't see it that way. Some primitive, you know, person that's, you know, worshiping whatever doesn't see it that way. But that's the truth of it, is that it's, and the fifth epical revelation, see, again, is they're rugged truths. Do you have the courage to face the facts of prayer? See that prayer is actually more valuable than you ever imagined it was when you thought it was something that wielded a changeable God. That it's actually a very subtle, deep grounding in the whole and the individuality of the whole. You know, that it's a subtle step towards consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother.
We're not supposed to be praying to ask, but we're supposed to be praying to understand the Father's will. A changeless God would already have, the will would already be known. So aren't we just praying to help understand that more than we are
prayer is an, you know how much there is in the book about prayer. You know how extensive of an evolutionary phenomenon prayer is. Prayer means 100 million things throughout your journey from single-celled organism to finality. What I'm saying, it doesn't change that. I mean, it means whatever it can mean at any point. Initially, all it can mean is, in our understanding, is tied to that relation of consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father. Because you only start out understanding how that you're initiated. One day you go, wait a minute, I think I am. And so the prayer, you know, has a relationship to that, kind of acknowledging that starting point and that first, you know, effort to consecrate your will. What we're just saying is, we live in an evolutionary universe, so the fact of prayer evolves just like everything evolves. God the Supreme evolves. Everything evolves. So you can choose to evolve your relationship to prayer, but guess what? Even if you don't choose, your relationship to prayer will evolve because we progress in spite of ourselves. The Supreme is evolving us. Your mind is much different than a mind of a creature 2,000 years ago, you know, of a mortal 2,000 years ago. You can't help but pray differently because God the Supreme has changed minds. They're different minds than they were before. So prayer just evolves, you know, and so you're just recognizing that fundamentally that's fine because you want to be part of an evolutionary phenomenon. You don't want to be something that is so bound to the existential that it begins to go against the flow of the Supreme. That's actually unwittingly, setting yourself, you know, there's things you can take a prayer and you can actually begin to use it to separate yourself from evolution. And that can lead to problems. If you get too far removed from the evolution of the Supreme, you can become self-righteous. See, that's, you know, think about that with prayer. If you really believe that you have the power to wield God with prayer, man, that's a pretty short step to self-righteousness from that. If you really believe that deeply, see, this is kind of dicey. You got to be careful, you know, about what you do with these things. And that's kind of what, you know, that's all I'm trying to bring. But let yourself be with prayer wherever you are with prayer. And then seek for whatever the next greater relationship is that you can find. Because there's always something greater. And there's nothing wrong with where you are right now. Because you're not imperfect in prayer. You're perfecting in prayer. Okay? There's nothing wrong with where anyone is in prayer. A very primitive person in the depths of New Guinea is not wrong in prayer, no matter how primitive they are. Okay, so but just you know, allow it to be dynamic.
Prayer gives you strength within. I mean, you have to believe, you have to have some kind of faith, and when you pray, if I pray, I'm feeling that God is right there with me, listening to everything I say, knowing exactly what I'm going to say, but giving me the strength, the fortitude to carry on in this life or wherever, you know, so that's the importance of prayer. I mean, you can't really do without prayer, because without it, you have no faith, and you have no...
Yeah, and just mark and wonder what your prayer life will be like on the first mansion world.
It's not like you're asking for anything. You're just with him, and that's a prayer.
So that's all I'm doing is just trying to open up. Don't let prayer have a period at the end of it. You know, open it up. Let it evolve. Let it have a future. Let it have a destiny. Just using this opportunity to remind you of how much, you know, you can think about these things. Don't let any of these things just be sitting on a shelf in your mind. You've got anything all figured out, you've just got it on a shelf. Worship's on a shelf, prayer's on a shelf, God's on a shelf, angels are on a shelf.
And your book's on a shelf.
Yeah, and your book is on a shelf, yes. Okay. Okay, so that's the six. That's the six known ones. And then what do they do for the time being about that seventh place? Okay.
Seven, the Evangels of Light. At the present time, every Finaliter company numbers 999 personalities of oath status, permanent members. The vacant place is occupied by the chief of attached Evangels of Light, assigned on any single mission. But these beings are only transient members of the core.
So just one little thing there. So you notice that there's more than just the one that's really kind of quasi-attached. There's a whole crew that might be. So the Finaliter companies that are on this world, you know, there may be more than 1,000 technically, because there may be a lot more than just one Evangel of Light attached to one of those companies. Okay.
Any celestial personality assigned to the service of any Finaliter Corps is denominated an Evangel of Light. These beings do not take the Finaliter oath, and though subject to the Corps organization, they are not of permanent attachment. This group may embrace solitary messengers, Supernafim, Sakonafim, Paradise Citizens, or their trinitized offspring, any being required in the prosecution of a transient Finaliter assignment. Whether or not the Corps is to have these beings attached to the eternal mission, we do not know. At the conclusion of attachment, these Evangels of Light resume their former status.
Okay. Now, so, you know, like I mentioned, you know, we kind of saw this with the gravity messengers, where there's one that's actually part of the core, and you have others. You've got a similar thing, too. You have this group of evangels, and one of them bonds that group to the core. And notice the one little twist they threw in there about creature trinitized sons. It appears that the Evangels of Light are only the Paradise Citizen flavor. See? Paradise Citizens or their trinitized offspring. Not sure if anyone can think of another spot in the book where they might explain that a little bit. I don't recall anything that differentiates like that between, say, Havona creature trinitized sons and Paradise creature trinitized sons. It seems to be distinguished here. So that's kind of a curiosity. There apparently is something about that. And, you know, I mean, your first thought is like, well, okay, there already are Havona natives officially in the mortal core. So is it something to do with that? That these evangels have to be different, more different than a Havona creature trinitized son in order to effectively do this seventh place? Or I'm curious. There's something there. You know, we know that this seventh place, even in this temporary mode, is has to be doing something, has to be adding some sort of quite transcendent element to the mix. Because we saw that, you know, that when you, you know, if you remember, if you go back to the beginning of the paper, you know, when you look at the list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and we're going, you know, where's the 7? Is it after 6 or is it before 1? You know, remember, we were, I think it's before 1. You know, so it's something very, very transcendent. So maybe that's what it is. But I, yeah, I certainly can't tell you exactly what's going on there. You know, or even, you know, it's probably even only certain paradise citizens, you know, and those sorts of things that they're not revealing. Okay, let's see. Anything else there?
Well, one of the things
you got thought there?
You could be sure of would it be paradise citizens that making their descent.
Yeah, 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 right.
It wouldn't be paradise citizens that were still hanging out. Not
yeah, right, yeah, point well taken, yeah.
The ones, and there's that curious fact that when Gran Fonda arrived in Havona, the first paradise right. citizen also
right.
went down
that onto way. The first so circuit, yeah.
There's always that reciprocal
right.
thing going on, and so clearly these are the guys that have maybe finished, have gotten to the seventh circuit.
Right. We don't talk about that a lot. I mean, you know, as we'll see in a little bit, you know, remember there's a core of paradise finaliters, you know, where some of those descending paradise citizens obviously must end up. You know, and Andre's bringing in the, see, obviously maybe some of them also do these temporary duties. And yeah, I was, you know, thanks for bringing it up. I was thinking of, we don't know what the diversity is of the different descending paradise citizens, you know, and whether or not, see that, if certain ones go into the paradise finality core, certain ones do this just because of their original nature, I don't know. You know, or does it have to do mostly with experience? There are different experiences in Havona, it's hard to say. But, you know, remember they tell you that they really can't say very much. I mean, they say paradise citizen quite a few times, but they really can't tell us much details. So you're left to just speculate by and large. All right.
As the mortal core of the finality is at present constituted, there are just 6 classes of permanent members. The finaliters, as might be expected, engage in much speculation as to the identity of their future comrades, but there is little agreement among them. We of Uversa often conjecture respecting the identity of the 7th group of finaliters. We entertain many ideas embracing possible assignment of some of the accumulating core of the numerous cores of the numerous trinitized groups on Paradise, Vice Jerrington, and the Inner Havona Circuit. It is even conjectured that the cores of the finality.
That the core of the finality may be, yeah. That's, it's singular there. You're talking about the mortal core there.
You have to just take it in context.
Yeah, you have to figure out in context, yeah. Okay.
It is even conjectured that the core of the finality may be permitted to trinitize many of their assistants in the work of universe administration in the event they are destined to the service of universes now in the making.
You know, it's always handy if it's in the context where you have an obviously plural verb. Figure it out immediately. But, so, you know, here, you know, like we were just pointing out, it's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure number 7 is before number 1 in the list of 6. See, that's what you're seeing here behind this speculation a little bit. There's more to bringing in the Inner Havona Circuit there than just, you know, you've got trinitized groups there. You know, so I'm sure some of these relatives are arguing, or some celestials argue, that the fact that they're pretty sure that the missing one is the 1 of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, not the 7 of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, makes the inner circuit all the more suspicious. See, that would be their argument, I would guess. Let's see, anything else there? I was going to mention, you notice that even when we get into the mortal core, this isn't clear. You know, they've talked to lots of finaliters, obviously, and they're all over the map on it. So taking that oath doesn't clear up this issue. You're just going to join one camp that celestials have been in for trillions of years speculating about this, where you come down on it. Okay, you know, that reminds you again, too, not immediately here, but, you know, those times when the revelators admit their ignorance about something, and you think, well, couldn't they go ask so-and-so, you know, because so-and-so must know, but so-and-so doesn't talk, you know. So, you know, like, for instance, an architect could probably tell you lots of things, but mum's the word. Architects don't talk about a lot of things. Yes, and you don't need to know. And one of the main reasons, you know, that you can always suspect is in play is if some things were told that would short-circuit the evolutionary process. So that ignorance is part of the value. It's not supposed to be existential. It's not supposed to just be. It has to evolve into existence. You know, all information and whatnot. All right?
One of us holds the opinion that this vacant place in the core will be filled by some type of being of origin in the new universe of their future service. The other inclines to the belief that this place will be occupied by some type of paradise personality not yet created, eventuated, or trinitized. But we will most likely await the entrance of the finaliters upon their seventh stage of spirit attainment before we really know.
Couple little twists there. You know, it always catches you off guard when you think about the eternal fact of paradise, you know, being spoken of in temporal terms like that, it seems. Some type of paradise personality not yet created, eventuated, or trinitized. Like, well, I thought it was eternity. But there's this relationship of the eternal with the temporal, like Havona, changing when the super universe level came into existence. You're seeing it's even true of paradise. Paradise, you know, is not pure changelessness. You know, it has some definitive things like it's motionless. It is the absolute of time. It's eternity and some of these things. But there is this linkage to the temporal. After all, we're talking about glorified mortals who are, you know, case in point of that. You have a relationship to this place, and you're a long ways away from, you know, literal future eternity. Okay? And, you know, you're going back out in time. You know, you have a relationship with time still. So to think about how you may have a changeless universal father, but change comes in with a lot of other things. I mean, the eternal son changed, as it were, became the eternal mother son, you know, through experience in Havona. These sorts of things. I mean, see, just reminding you that the only pure existential changeless fact is God the Father. And even the aisle, see, has some changing things going on with it. Okay. Now, the core paradiseness, you know, is changeless. Me standing on the aisle, I'm not the embodiment of paradiseness. I'm just a finaliter, say. I have a relationship to that changelessness. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting to actually understand what the heck all that means that I'm talking about, how change and eternity work together somehow. And that's very mysterious.
So, you mentioned, talk to me about the title a little bit.
Oh.
The Evangels of Light.
Oh.
You know, you can talk a little bit about the Dr. Seraphim. I'm still trying to come up, where'd they come up with that?
The only thought I've had so far is just in relationship of what we were talking about a little bit ago, that in a sense, all of the finaliter core are evangels of light. The light of the next age basically shining into this age. They go to a world settled in light and life and begin to administer that. They begin to inject the light of the next age subtly into that. And so calling this this variable element of the finality company that actually allows them to tailor fit themselves to the temporal place that they're plugging into and bringing that light into. My thought is that, see, they're sort of like the spear points, or the conduit for their transcendent light to shine into time. They're kind of how they plug in.
Evangelizing.
And they change the kind of, socket that they have, or whatever you want to say, depending on their mission. So I think that's my thought about why they really, exemplify this, that what my finalities are up to is trying to bring the transcendent light, into now. And that's why the next thing we talk about is the transcendentalers. See, that this recognition that, that's really fundamentally what they're doing. And probably as finalities, they don't even fully appreciate how they're doing that. They've taken an oath to the Paradise Trinity, and they do what they're told. And when the grand universe is settled in light and life, they too will look back and go, oh, that's why I was told to do that back then. You need some way, to really get something that's fundamentally transcendent down into time and space. So that's my thought. That's why I think they're called that. Okay. You can really kind of see, if you're trying to figure out what the company is doing, the finalers themselves are kind of subtle and mysterious. But if you look at, say, the Supernafim or whatever, or the Solitary Messenger, you can kind of track them better. Those people who are watching is like, oh, I think it has something to do with this, because I know how Supernafim work, and so they're kind of how you can see the light, the evangels of the light. And that's my guess. Maybe it's a rationalization scene, but that's the best I've come up with at this point. Okay, so in that sense, let's read this first little bit about the transcendentalers, and then next time we'll get into all the details about the architects. But before you start, again, this should really bring it home. Why do they talk about transcendentalers and specifically the architects in this paper? Because there is a linkage between finaliters and them that is very direct. That's why I pointed out, that's why they're called finaliters, because the word final is tied to the ultimate. Especially if you say God the ultimate, and we're talking about that which only exists at the final end point of future eternity. In other words, the finaliters are directly in relationship. That's why they're called finaliters. They're directly in relationship with the ultimate. They're the beginnings of ultimate personality activity, even while they're still just working on supreme personality activity within the finite. We're about to read who swears you in. The chief of them all. If you need any further evidence that this is fundamentally what you're about as a finaliter, you're about the next age. You're really, in many ways, being taken out of really working in the trenches at the level of the trenches, and you're now part of the antecedent following. You're part of the transcendent coming in and illuminating, evangels of light, illuminating time. Okay, so let's see what they say here.
8, the transcendentalers. Part of the perfected mortal's experience on paradise as a finaliter consists in the effort to achieve comprehension of the nature and function of more than 1,000 groups of the transcendental super citizens of paradise, eventuated beings of absinthe attributes. In their association with these super personalities, the ascendant finaliters receive great assistance from the helpful guidance of numerous orders of transcendental ministers who are assigned to the task of introducing the evolved finaliters to their new paradise brethren. The entire order of the transcendentalers live in the west of paradise in a vast area which they exclusively occupy.
You can't help but delight at the you know, the Northern European traditions, you know, and others too, even actually, of, you know, going to the west to your destiny. Sure enough, there they live in the west of paradise. So remember how this is possible. I mean, you know, that you could be trying to come into relationship with these transcendentalers. You've achieved, you know, your first measures of relationship with the absolute existential level in the inner life in order to get there. And that the consequence of that is you can begin to have the very first measures of a relationship to the supreme experiential level in the outer life. That's if all you could still do is have a relationship with a finite experiential level in the outer life, you couldn't become a paradise citizen or resident, you know, wouldn't have residential status on paradise. You couldn't have this outer life thing going. If you didn't have that first measure of ability to engage the supreme experiential level in the outer life, which has an initial thread of relationship to the absolute outer life of the aisle, and everything in between, like absinthe beings. Okay, so that's, you're starting to try to apply this initial ability that you have to have this greater experience on the aisle, and even with transcendental beings. And, you know, reminding you of how tenuous of an ability you have in this regard, you make a little effort to reach up, and there's these apparently special transcendentalers that have a distinct ability to reach down and meet you where you are in your lowly estate as just a beginning finaliter. Kind of like when you talk about the force organizers, and you have the primary ones that are distinctly bounded away from the finite and are, you know, definitively absinthe, but the associate ones, you know, that can work on the interface between the absinthe and the finite. So you apparently have some transcendentalers here too that are designed to be able to interface, you know, reach down and help you there where you are, kind of on the boundary, and they'll enter, you know, be the intermediary for you, for those who are really bounded away. You know, like for instance, this senior architect is going to be very, very bounded away from the finite boundary. So there's going to have to be some sort of a way of allowing him to minister the oath as a very, very transcendent being. And maybe just remember, you know, this is really, remember how amazing this is that they're telling us about transcendentalers. Remember what we read back in paper 30. This is, that we're getting this kind of information is very rare.
In the discussion of transcendentalers, we are restricted not only by the limitations of human comprehension, but also by the terms of the mandate governing these disclosures concerning the personalities of paradise. These beings are in no way connected with the mortal ascent to Havona. The vast hosts of the paradise transcendentalers have nothing whatever to do with the affairs of either Havona or the seven super universes, being concerned only with the super administration of the affairs of the master universe.
Just, you know, in that regard, I was just referring to back there in paper 30. Remember what they said about, you know, you have to, normally it's not until a local universe is settled in light and life, okay? See, that light and life and the relationship of the transcendentalers and to those, you know, really starting to connect those to the next age, those units, be they a world or a local universe or whatever. So you know, you can see that here. That's why it's when it's normally revealed, because it's only then for the local universe that these beings are relevant. They just don't have anything to do with all those ascending affairs, even the local universe ascending up to the super universe level and being part of the super universe administration. See, they don't have anything to do with all that ascension stuff, be they being or universe. Okay, but once that is ascended, then boom, there they are. Long before the grand universe being settled in light and life, the transcendentalists are very interested in you and are engaging you very directly. Okay, so that's this, you know, that helps you to understand why that's such an extreme statement back there. Okay.
You, being a creature, can conceive of a creator, but you can hardly comprehend that there exists an enormous and diversified aggregation of intelligent beings who are neither creators nor creatures. These transcendentalers create no beings, neither were they ever created. In speaking of their origin, in order to avoid using a new term, an arbitrary and meaningless designation, we deem it best to say that transcendentalers simply eventuate. The deity absolute may well have been concerned in their origin and may be implicated in their destiny, but these unique beings are not now dominated by the deity absolute. They are subject to God the ultimate, and their present paradise sojourn is in every way Trinity supervised and directed.
Okay, so the last part again, you know, it's all about the Trinity, and just like with God the Supreme, you know, the personal spiritual aspect of God the Ultimate comes from the Paradise Trinity. It's that whole experiential deity thing we've been talking about. And remember, in the mode when they bring in the deity absolute like this. This is, and initially when they're talking about such things, they speak of it in seven absolutes of infinity terms. You know, what they're really referring to there is God the Absolute. Okay? That God the Absolute must have a lot to do with these things. In other words, it's God the Absolute is a transcendent context for God the Ultimate. And it's God the Ultimate that they're immediately about. See, so that's why they're saying that. Obviously, there must be some antecedent following on that other boundary, you know, of the absolute into the ultimate. Just like there's the ultimate into the supreme, etc. Okay, so there's that. Why do they choose to use our word eventuate for this? I've pointed that out many times. I mean, it's the only way that we can get some sense of what this is about. If you, once you wrap your mind around evolution, the idea of evolution, things evolving, you come to recognize that eventually evolution is complete. Okay? That word eventuate is referring to that temporal endpoint, that if you think about a process eventually coming to completion, when you speak of eventuate, you're speaking about that endpoint, that eventually. And so when you think about, from the only way we can understand what gets balled up into their nature when they're brought into existence is that the total essence of the eventually of evolution, see, is all balled up into their starting point. They begin by nature where evolution ends, at the completion point, the eventually point of evolution. And once you see that in that sort of grand context of, you know, the full evolution of the finite and the grand universe being settled in light and life, and then the absentite building upon that, then you can bring in a modified, you know, some of the antecedent following, if it were, some of the further recognition that it's not all just black and white like that. That actually everything in the finite involves some measure of eventuation. Everything is eventuated to some degree, greater or lesser degree. I mean, just simply, you know, your existence sitting here. It didn't take 550 million years or even 450 million years for you to gestate your mother's womb. By and large, all that evolution was balled up into your beginning. Now, you were all of that evolution was eventuated into your starting point. You built upon that measure of completion of evolution. So there's that. Or when we talk about the substance of beings' bodies, say a seraphim, you know, we'll call them spirit creatures, but technically there's some sort of blend of physical and spiritual energy, homogeneous blend, that has an absonite quality to it, that blend. There's an innate harmony of relationship between the individuality and unity, material and spiritual, that they didn't have to evolve into their bodies. It was just balled up in their, you know, given it by fiat to begin with. Okay? Now, we, you know, start out as basically purely material, and so all of that, you know, we have to literally experience bringing all that, you know, but beings high and low have various measures of this, you know, given to them as a starting point. They don't get to experience that harmonization. They get to experience only subsequent harmonization. We get to experience just about all harmonization that's possible, you know, starting with, you know, basically all of the one stuff in one pile and us in the other pile, and we're going to try to slowly bring in the unity, the spirit, and weave it into this, and eventually it's all going to be together as one in a nice homogeneous blend. But throughout our whole local universe career, we can't even get it to being homogeneous. It's a heterogeneous weave, you know, of Marantia energy, where you can still see the two different separate fibers, as it were. You know, it takes us that long to even get the beginnings of, you know, of blending it together, like it's blended together in a seraphim, say, right from the beginning, in terms of their energy nature. Okay, so that's why eventuate, because it's the eventually of evolution. So you can kind of understand, begin to understand what absonite substance, what absonite nature is.
Transcendental and absolute pretty much the same.
Yeah, you know, obviously you're implying different things by or focusing on different things when you use the two terms, but the interesting thing about transcendental relative to just saying absonite is the word transcendental implies some measure of relationship to the finite. You know, by saying it that way, you're trying to emphasize that these beings, they're absonite beings, but they have a relationship to the finite. They're not bounded away from the finite. They transcend the finite. You know, they're above, but not totally beyond, as it were. Okay.
So, it's gonna go a little bit.
Okay. Okay.
So if out in the outer space levels, and the, you know, and the, when the supreme is manifest and the ultimate is beginning, like the supreme does, you know, and there are absonite beings out there, and let's say we do end up out there servicing and doing things, etc.,
mm-hmm.
and we're dealing with absonite beings that are not even existing yet today, maybe because they're eventuated, they show up, and they do talk. You know, they mentioned there that one of some people surmised that. You know, we may be teaching them a little bit about what, you know, experience is all about or evolution is all about.
Right, that's the last section in this paper.
All right.
Yep. Yep.
I'm just trying to get this picture.
Yep.
So we learn all that because we go through all that and we get it all. We learn it by living it and becoming it. And then we, you know, hopefully, like the whole pattern of everything else, we then help them to be able to get what they don't get because... they eventuate, kind of what you said a minute ago, which really helped me a lot. they're coming out of the womb of, you know, of experience, so to speak, or of the supreme, so to speak, into this thing of the ultimate. And but they're the same kind of being as a transcendentaler in a way, even though they may not have been eventuated yet.
Well, see, even you, you know, all of us in the next age will be absentite beings.
Oh, really?
Right.
So we will evolve from...
Right. All finite, of every nature, all finiteness in galaxies and everything, in creatures, all finiteness will be balled up into the cores of everything. And everything that will be going on will be built upon that. I've tried to point this out. I mean, it's hard to even imagine. I mean, all finite geometry will cease to exist. All finite, you know, distances and angles will be balled up in the core of things. Those finite distances and angles won't even exist anymore. All finite will be embodied in the core of things. You know, what does that mean? What does that mean? You know, there still will be separation and everything, but there won't be any finite separations anymore. There won't be any finite angles anymore. There'll be absentite geometry. And so, right, I mean, that's the whole bit about a seventh stage spirit. See, is making that transition from a finite creature who is maximizing supreme personality activity to becoming an absentite creature, a super creature, you know,
including
working on ultimate.
And spirit fuse and people who stay here.
None of the revelators have any idea what happens to all these. But yeah, I mean, where are they all going with it? But no matter what, all finite things will be at an end. Yeah. I mean, ancients of days have to get transformed. I mean, everything has to, yeah, everything has to be transformed. All finite comes to an end, which is just hard to understand. Okay.
When the God of finite manifests.
Right. When, see, the finite God, when he, you know, when the total gets balled up, you know, into his core, and, you know, and, see? So that now he's liberated, he's freed himself from the fetters of unqualified supremacy, you know, and he's able to act because he was, you know, everything that sort of was imprisoning him, he's managed to ball up inside of him, so now he's free.
No wonder they worship God.
Yep. Yep.
The super personalities that they mention as these citizens.
Right.
Paragraph one. How are they related to the super personalities of the sun's circuit?
Difference. That remember we talked about that. That's the primary way to use the term super something like super personality is related to absentite beings. But they decided they couldn't, rather than dreaming up some other term, they couldn't think of one to dream up. They said, "Well, I'm going to use it for that too." But that's a different super personality. It's, you know, it's above personalities, but in a different way. So you have to remind yourself of the kind of the qualification or the asterisk or the quotes or whatever around that when they're talking about those personalities. You know, even calling them beings and everything. Remember, everything about it is mysterious. So, yeah, but they got to use some word. So. Okay, what else? Oh, yeah, we have the last paragraph here. Let's get this done.
Although all mortals who attain paradise frequently fraternize with the transcendentalers, as they do with the paradise citizens, it develops that man's first serious contact with the transcendentaler occurs on that eventful occasion when, as a member of a new finaliter group, the mortal ascender stands in the finaliter receiving circle as the Trinity Oath of Eternity is administered by the chief of transcendentalers, the presiding head of the architects of the master universe.
Okay, and just that last statement, we'll get into the architects next time, but that that's a very important statement. It's a clue. When you're working with these transcendentalers, every single word is important because they're pushing the revelation mandate to its limits. They're trying to give you as many clues as possible, okay? He's not just the chief of the master architects, chief of transcendentalers, okay? So the senior architect is something more than the senior architect. The senior architect is the absonite one, capital A, capital O, okay? Like the supreme being is the supreme one, or, you know, there's the ultimate one, okay? He's chief of transcendentalers, the highest absonite being of all absonite beings. The absonite one. And that's something that you recognize when you unpack
total. Not the ultimate.
No. That's the ultimate one. Right? Which is higher than the absonite one. Okay? But not as high as the co-absolute one, or et cetera. Okay. But see, that's, you recognize that as you methodically unpack total deity. You know, for those of you who have gone through the Total Deity Seminar, that's one of the things that we unpack along the way, is recognizing that the senior architect is the absonite one. And as we get into the next section, we'll get a little tip of the hat to the co-absolute one. All right. So next time we've got the last two sections. We should finish up this paper. We finish up part one. Tune in next time. Let's take a moment here.